always find it interesting to hear some of the local or domestic U.S. perspective and some of the issues that they're facing here in the United States, one of the acknowledged high resource countries with still very vulnerable populations that require a safety net for services, and that those safety nets have the potential to grow some pretty big holes. And so sustainability really is an issue when we're looking at those safety nets. Our final presenter is Lisa Tarantino. She's an associate for Banyan Global and is serving as the banking and business manager on the Banking on Health project. She manages programs in Romania, Georgia, Ethiopia, and the Philippines, and has more than 12 years' experience in SME development and finance in Eastern Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Since 2004, she's been applying this expertise to private health sector development.
Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to go a bit off script. I have too many slides, and we don't have a lot of time, so I'm going to, if you have questions, you can address them during the question and answer period, if that's okay. Okay, here we go. So the Banking on Health project is a USAID global project working in 10 countries. The goal of the project is to improve the ability of private healthcare businesses to access finance, and thus allowing them to make improvements in the quality and to expand their services. Why is this an issue? Okay, we've all been seeing the headlines recently about this huge credit crunch happening all over the world. And even though none of us are economists, or maybe there are some economists, we're learning how a lack of credit can help even very good and strong businesses who deserve it, or can hurt them, actually, rather. It can hurt them if they don't get it. But this has been the reality of private healthcare providers throughout the world, particularly in less developed countries, where they're not getting access to finance. I've talked to an OBGYN in Ethiopia who said he scrimped and saved for 5 years, working 7 days a week to get a sonogram. Banks in most of these countries where we work do not significantly lend to the health sector. They think of these, particularly these small-scale facilities, as being high risk. They're not particularly interested in the kind of collateral they have to offer for their loans. And they could be getting some poor quality applications, where a lot of times you have very skilled and dedicated clinicians who don't necessarily have the business skills to put together a bankable business plan. So Banking on Health, we work with both the providers to improve their credit readiness, and we also work with financial institutions to increase their comfort in lending to the sector. And the whole purpose is to increase the financing and to improve reproductive health and family planning outcomes. So just briefly about Romania. I could talk about Romania all day, but some of the important points is that the starting point for when USAID began working in Romania is that it had one of the worst health situations for women in that region at that time. The rate of abortion was more than 4 per woman. It had a very high maternal mortality rate. And you can see here from this graph that women's access to family planning was limited to specialist clinics and specialists working in public facilities in primarily urban areas. This was given to me, this map, from an organization called the Society for Education in Contraceptives and Sexuality, I should say. So women in rural areas, where 70% of the poor of Romania live, had to travel to the city. And did they? Not often. They didn't have the money, they didn't have the time to do this. So through a series of policy changes and also with training of family doctors, family planning and reproductive health services became more greatly integrated into primary health care. So family doctors are now able to offer counseling and products to women in rural areas. And that had a significant impact on the abortion rate, the maternal mortality rate, and the modern contraceptive prevalence use in Romania. So when Banking on Health started working in Romania, it was already a success story. But USAID was preparing to depart the country by early 2008, and there were concerns that these gains that had only been recently made could backslide and could not be sustained. I want to skip this, actually. So what did we do? We decided to focus on these family doctors in rural areas. They were important members of the communities. They historically had been employees of the public system and had been let go. They were owning their own practices now. They had to pay their own workers. Most of them were under contract with the federal government to offer a basic package of services. But they were really on their own managing these practices. And we had a theory that they were facing some barriers to managing sustainably and accessing finance. I should also point out that they were working in the same facilities they had inherited under the public system. They didn't have the right to purchase them. There was a law in the book saying they could, but it wasn't being enforced. So they were in sort of a degrading physical environment, let's put it that way. So we started with market research. We surveyed more than 10% of the family doctors in Romania using a random selection process and stratifying by location. And what did we find? Our research allowed us to put together a really nice picture of who these family doctors are. More than 50% are offering family planning, and this correlates almost exactly to the percentage that had been given this kind of training through another USAID project there run by JSI. The average age was 48 years. They were experienced, mainly women, who had been in their same practice for quite a number of years, and individual practices, usually with one nurse and a couple part-time employees. On average, they had a little over 1,800 clients with 581 visits in a month, and on average, for those offering family planning, they had 22 visits in a month. So even though they were legally allowed to offer services outside of their contract, we found that only 5% of their total income came from fee-for-services. So they were really reliant on their income that they were getting from the National Health Insurance House, as it's called. Okay, and these figures are in Romanian lei. So in total, the doctors were earning, this was about, I think, $1,500 at that time. Their incomes, their monthly incomes were low, but their expenses were also low. And we did find that while they were not earning huge amounts of money, they were sustaining themselves, and they had a profit. So when we're thinking about access to finance for improvements or growth, there was a little bit of cash flow for them to work with to pay back a potential loan. They had been getting continuing medical education training, but very few had any business or financial management training, as you can see, only 4%. When we asked them what they were interested for training in the future, most of them are still very focused on their clinical training, but we were surprised to see that a good 60% were interested in business management training and 36% in financial management. So the business topics are still important to them, which, by the way, a lot of people were saying, apps, they're not interested in this kind of thing. And so this data was very interesting. A lot of people who should know, let's put it that way. We asked them about what they thought about their contract with the government, and the responses were mixed. Among those who viewed the contract as impacting their practice favorably, they really valued the stability. Others who had a less favorable view of the contract felt that they were being held back, that they were not able to access financing or to improve or grow their practice. And this was in part related to the contract. The contracts were only 1 year in duration. Every year it could change. And the family doctors' associations at that time were playing a limited role in terms of negotiating this contract. So the doctors were feeling a bit powerless about their future. And when we asked them, what is the number one thing limiting your profitability, they said that they felt that their services were not being paid enough, and this was directly related to the contract. So in spite of their many complaints about their situations, a good 95% said they did want to grow and improve their practices. And they were very specific. They wanted medical equipment. They wanted to purchase their office. And this was, again, interesting for those who were not so concerned about this law not being enforced, that, look, they want to purchase their offices, and 42% are even interested in getting a loan to make some improvements. Okay, and we asked them, and there was a range of types of equipment that they were interested in purchasing. And this particular slide caused great debate among family doctors and the Ministry of Health, because the Ministry of Health was saying, well, you don't need an electrocardiograph. Women or people, the population, they can go to the specialist centers and get one. And the family doctors were saying, yes, but do they have the time or the money, and are these services really accessible to them? And our argument is no. And we'll finance this ourselves. Just let us get the training and include it in our contract, or not. They wanted this even without this in their contract, so they're interested in expanding. And then some of the smaller things were things that were already required for them to have under their contract. They had little credit experience. Less than half, almost half, had never had a loan. And I should also point out, at this time in Romania, credit card usage was almost non-existent among these doctors. So those who did have a loan in the past, vast majority had used it to lease an automobile. Okay, I think we already talked about this a little bit. So what did we do? We used the data that we found to engage in some policy dialogue. We we showed this data to the practitioner associations, to the government, and also to the banks, and added our voices to people who are already talking about some of these issues. And the nice thing is to have data to back it up. So adding our voices to a number of voices, in June of 2007, the contract was changed, which resulted in a nearly 70% increase in income for the family doctors. So that had an immediate impact on them, but it also increases their ability to access financing and leverage for more growth. And there is a greater enforcement of this law, allowing for the purchase of facilities, and this is information we got from our banking colleagues, that they're seeing that greater clients are borrowing for this purpose. Those are the two main. We also worked with the financial institutions by providing them with training and technical assistance on marketing and product development to the private healthcare sector. And here the results were surprising and exciting. Four of the five institutions introduced a new loan products for doctors and for pharmacies. One bank, right here, Bank of Transylvania, established a dedicated medical sector division with dedicated staff, 50% of whom used to be in the medical profession, so they could communicate with the professionals in their own language. And they had a very nice marketing campaign, which inspired other banks to get more into the sector as well, including startup loans, which up until that point in Romania were practically unheard of, to get a loan to start a new business. So it was only for medical professionals. Among our banking partners, we saw a growth of approximately $83 million in their portfolio. So this is funding that they're using their own commercial funds, and they're lending it to the doctors so they can grow their practices, some for other purposes. Another interesting thing about what happened is that as more institutions became involved, the terms for doctors specifically as a subgroup got better. Their interest rates for their loans went down, and they were able to get longer-term loans. They were seen as an attractive market for the banks. For the family doctors, We work very closely with a project run by JSI in Romania and developed a course called Enhancing the Financial Health of the Medical Practice. And the purpose of this course was really to give the doctors some tools that they could use to more effectively manage their practices and to make good decisions about their financing. Okay. And here we found, after training 140 doctors throughout the country, we surveyed 77 of them and found that the vast majority were still using the tools that we had given them. 24% had taken out a new loan, which was about $250,000 in total for these new loans, and they used them for their businesses to expand or renovate their clinics, to purchase new equipment and products. And here we have a nice little quote from a family doctor from our very first course who said, "In 1989, we were dropped into the water by the Ministry of Health, and they didn't teach us how to swim. And now, finally, you're teaching us." It was lovely. She said it to me. It was lovely, and with witnesses. but then we are tracking the health results. So going to these same doctors that went through the training, we found that 26% had an increase in the provision of family planning products and counseling, and condoms, IUD, oral contraceptives, injectables. And then using our baseline national survey, our national research survey as a baseline, comparing doctors who had family planning training only with those who went through the training in financial management, we found that those who had gone through the training were more likely to be offering the entire range of services. And I should say that our case study, even though it was about financial management, of course, Dr. Roxana Popa offered family planning and reproductive health to her patients, and there were business as well as clinical reasons for that. Okay, and these are just some questions that I'm throwing out. So, thank you. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't go too far over.
Thank you, Lisa. So that's the end of our presentations today, and we are hitting actually about the time that our session's supposed to end. But because we had some technical difficulties, and I want to thank all the presenters, too, for trying to cram in their 20-minute presentations and make them a little bit shorter. It's the last minute that's a very hard thing to do as a presenter, so I appreciate everyone's efforts. But I'm going to make an executive decision, since we had technical difficulties, that we will continue for the next 10 minutes and take some questions and allow people to ask our panelists questions or comments.
On Malawi and Uganda, are you being able to be heard in this conclusion?
The question was just, it can be hard. In Malawi and Uganda, are people hearing, listening to the results that they found?
That the government is the sustainable organization?
I'll say from Washington, D.C., the answer is yes. Whether Uganda will listen, I don't know. So, is that a good answer?
Might be a true one.
You're saying the government of Uganda would disagree that they should be the provider?
I don't know. I think I'm approaching this from USAID side in terms of what would we do. In Malawi, it seems we are working more closely with the government.
Yes.
And it seems, in terms of spread of facilities, the government of Malawi has more in rural areas than we probably can easily do with private sectors of drug support. So in Uganda, why are we not doing the same thing? And people will say, well, essentially, maybe the government of Uganda is, the president has a different opinion. Maybe I really don't know. You know, this is supply. It seems to be, let us talk out the facilities. I don't know if that people are telling also why they think it's easier to support the family planning from the private sector in Uganda. So, somebody wants to.
Yeah, I saw that you talked about the policy environment in Uganda and wondered.
president of Uganda is a very pro-natalist in the way he comes out, that he thinks Uganda population needs to continue to grow. He doesn't see any problem. Now, where this translates to reality on the ground, that I cannot say. So, why people in Uganda decide to be supporting the private sector but the public sector is an ongoing question that I'm going to ask, and it's part of the reason for doing this type of analysis to show people that this is a policy decision that was made by USAID to shift more to the public sector in Uganda.
Because of that, it would be counterproductive. Recently,
yeah, okay.
Like in the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
But the fertility rate has remained constant for almost 2 decades. So the thing is that I don't think that his recent change of mind and starts to about land population is really the issue here. Because if you just look at the method mix in Uganda, for some reason, USAID, for some reason, stopped supporting the long-term method completely. So how do you answer the issue of the unmet need, those who wish to stop, if long-term methods are kind of off the menu. Secondly, in Uganda, naturally, not even naturally, research has been shown that, in fact, what I think up to last year, it showed that 47% of people seek healthcare from the private sector, not from the public sector. So where do you put these services? Do you still put them in the public sector when you know that people don't necessarily seek services from there, or the majority seek services from the other side? So that could be a reason. And the other reason is when you look at some of the graphs showing in the CPR, the period 1990 to 1990, but there was a lot of push using the non-traditional service delivery systems like CBD, social marketing, and so on and so forth, were very prominent at that time. And all of a sudden, because of the shift in funding, going to HIV/AIDS and so on, these programs stopped. So that too would be the contributed to the sudden change in terms of utilizing access to services, where the traditional and non-traditional approaches kind of came to almost an end after just about 7 or 10 years in use. So I think that it is in Uganda, one needed to look at other factors that could be probably outside the compartment, whether it's the public sector as a source of services, and whether it is the policy environment, other factors really. I'm from Uganda, and I was part of the public planning for over
20 years. I would like to talk to you at the end. So please stay and let's talk more. So I don't want to take, let's give it at the end.
I wanted to give other panelists some time to answer some questions. Sorry. So if there are some others, other questions?
Sorry, my question is still on the same presentation.
Okay, all right.
Somewhat related to the point that, were you able, when you look at the DHS data, were you able to look at the private sector supply of contraceptives? And see what role the private sector actually plays in these changes in contraceptive prevalences in these two countries. And then maybe with that you might be able to clarify your conclusion at the end about the premature reliance on the private sector. What do you mean by that? Do you mean the underdevelopment of the private sector or underdevelopment of the public sector supply or both?
Is there any other question? I'm sure that I can just answer so I don't take all the time. Any other? No? Okay. Broadly, what I'm trying to say is that the public and private sector programs are the only two ways to provide family planning services. So whatever you see as a level of a private sector, if it's high, then public sector is low. I think it's 100% of the two. So So in a sense, what I consider premature is in terms of ability of the private sector to reach the rural areas at the same level, because they are mostly essentially to be driven by money, profit. So you stay where you're going to be able to recover what you are spending. If people in rural areas are able to afford to buy homes, except that is the online government which has to put a clinic or whatever in all these areas. So the ease of reach of rural areas for government, I think, to me is easier because it's from your services through the public sector, the government has to put services in rural areas.
Another question back here.
I have a question about training the physicians. Do you, you know, are those kinds of programs available? We have rural physicians in the United States who are basically running essentially free clinics in very underserved populations, or even clinics in urban areas. And I know most of us are just clueless. I'm amazed when I can balance my checkbook.
I own some PEs actually. You should do this in the U.S. too. I don't know. Actually, I have to tell you, I really exclusively work internationally, so I can't tell you what's available. I would assume there should be some because we have a pretty developed. Our associations here in the United States are pretty developed, so there may be some, but I'm not aware of it. But in most of the countries where we work, there isn't.
And Lisa, are your materials available on a website or something? I mean, it would probably take adaptation.
There is some materials from the Philippines, for some materials that we did for midwives there, which shows like a basic accounting system and how to put together financial statements. It's bankingonhealth.com. www.bankingonhealth.com. This Romanian course is not available online, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it.
Question
there, and then a question here. Christina, you did mention about the limitation in your study that you aren't able to control for those services provided through waivers. And my question is, in the future, you know, I work for one of those waivers, mm-hmm. and I'd like to find out if you have plans to conduct them. Evaluation, especially specifically to those services provided through waivers.
The question is about whether we have plans to conduct some analysis specifically focused on waivers, is that correct?
Yeah, and especially the impact of those waivers.
There is actually some evaluations that have been conducted of the waivers, and I'm sure you're probably aware of those that were conducted by Kathleen Adams and that group. They did an evaluation of six state waiver programs. So there's evidence that, one, that they're highly cost-effective investments, and that they result in more cost savings than what it costs to provide the waivers. And so there are some that exist. Right now we're using the NSFG data, individual level data. So what we could do is, with the 2000 data, we also have information on whether there was a waiver present or not and what type of waiver it was. So we can look at the effect at the individual level of the waiver by controlling for the waiver in the regressions. And we plan to do that, but we can only do it with the 2002 data. And we'd also control for whether there was an insurance mandate in the state also.
Thank you.
One last question and then we'll have to end, but I'm certain our panelists, at least a few have already said they're happy to stay a little bit and answer some questions. So if they have time, you can come and ask them.
Thank you. This question is for Lisa. Just out of curiosity, what is the distribution of pharmacy in Romania? You had a slide up there of pharmacy, and then you went on to say that you decided to use the doctor.
So
later on, the banks didn't have it all up with banks.
So basically, our
that's the potential.
One of the banks developed a product for pharmacies, working capital, by drug.
Well, thank you all, and thanks for your patience in our sort of shaky startup. So, and a reminder, we have some very nice materials here if you would like to grab some. And then also, the Management Sustainability Task Force meeting, which is tomorrow at 6:30. We would love to have you join us, and here's just some more information on it.
So, and we have copies from the video.
I think they're okay.
I need to load a new.
That's where we had.